Here's a chance. Couture shoots. Score! Two goals in 30 seconds.
And the Jets win it. 2-1. Winnipeg wins tonight in Buffalo.
Feeds Ovechkin. Slap shot. He scores.
They played better than us. They scored. They put more pucks to the net. They're more skilled than us.
The Capitals are Southeast Division champions.
Big plays, the big stories, the biggest news from across the hockey landscape. This is NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets and all things NHL. TSN 1290.
Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this evening at tsn1290.ca, good evening, universe, and welcome to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by my regular colleagues, Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Michael Remus is on loan to us from Rick Ralph and the Rona Roundtable. 2 hours of hockey talk coming your way on this Wednesday evening. Joining us in about 30 minutes' time to talk about the struggling Montreal Canadiens, our good friend Pat Hickey of the Montreal Gazette is going to join us 7:15 tonight from the Record in New Jersey. He covers the New York Rangers. Andrew Gross is going to join us. And in between now and then and everything else, all your favorite segments that we bring to you weekly here on NHL Midweek. Richie, Ezzy, good evening, gentlemen. How are you both doing?
Good, good. Ready to go. Ready to talk hockey, as always. One more game left on the season. We got 2 hours of hockey talk, so I'm ready to go.
I am as well, Drew. I mean, you're talking about the last few days of the season here, and then the best 2 weeks for a hockey fan, obviously, in the first round.
Agreed with your comments there. It looks like, so about 2.5 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago now, we were on the Saturday morning on the regular Illegal Curve Hockey Show, and we said 7-2. Should probably get the Winnipeg Jets into the playoffs. It's now looking that 7-1-1, if they win tomorrow, won't do the trick. You know, is it just a matter of the disparity between the top 8 or 9 teams in the East and the bottom 6 teams in the East was so great that nobody in front of the Winnipeg Jets was going to lose?
Not really, Drew. I don't think it's necessarily that. I mean, there are a lot of bad teams who have mailed it in, don't get me wrong, but you know, we said 7-2 would get them in the conversation, but wouldn't be a guarantee. And that's exactly what's happened. I mean, it hasn't been a guarantee. We thought it'd be close, and it is going to be close. But a lot of these teams have, I don't know if it's necessarily disparity, Drew, overall talent. I think a lot of the teams are playing some of the young guys and maybe not bringing the same effort, but I don't think the talent levels, the talent disparity is that significant. And I also think that what you're seeing in the NHL and really both sides is desperate teams are winning. And it happens to be the Jets are desperate amongst many other teams who are desperate. And I bet you if you went over the past 2-3 weeks, which team, quote-unquote, needed to win was probably winning at a 60 to 70% clip. That's just what's happened.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you, Richie. It's not disparity. I mean, look at the teams the Jets are chasing right now. You've got the Washington Capitals, one of the hottest teams in the league. The Islanders, one of the hottest teams in the league. The only team at the bottom of the Eastern Conference top 8 is the Ottawa Senators. They're the only team that's been struggling. So you've got the Jets chasing all of the hot teams in the league. And the Jets just played all non-playoff teams. They should beat those teams. Mm-hmm. At the beginning of the season, you know, I would have said the Carolina Hurricanes and the Tampa Bay Lightning were both playoff teams. They both had horrible goaltending. Now, that's because Cam Ward went out with an injury and the backups to Cam Ward couldn't get the job done. Kirk Muller said that himself. But as far as the Tampa Bay Lightning go, you know, they had a goaltender who just turned out to be one of the weaker starting goaltenders in the league. But the Jets have done what they've needed to do to get into the playoffs. If the Jets end up finishing the season 7-1-1 and miss the playoffs by 1 or 2 points, well, that means that they were, you know, just good enough to not make the playoffs. And I really think, you know, the Jets heading into the offseason, and really they're exactly where we thought they would be. And I know we're going to talk more about the Jets season on Saturday, but really they're a few pieces away from being a playoff team. They're not that far away. I don't think that they should hang their heads in shame, but they really don't deserve to make the playoffs when you consider that they beat a lot of teams that they should have beat earlier on in the season.
Look at the East. And you know, you look at the Boston and the Montreal and the Toronto situation in the Northeast, because that's pretty much the only thing aside from Ottawa and New York and the Jets, you know, final chances that's left to be settled. You know, of those three teams, first of all, how surprised are you that the Leafs have borderline played themselves into the conversation regarding the Northeast division?
Well, I think it's more so Boston and Montreal played themselves out of the played Toronto in the conversation.
Sure, that's fair. I mean, you look at Toronto, and if they win out and Montreal loses tomorrow night, then Toronto, I mean, then the Leafs are going to finish ahead of the Montreal Canadiens, because the Leafs and the Habs play each other on the final Saturday night. It's just stunning that, you know, this turnaround for the Toronto Maple Leafs this year. I mean, with a roster that is just doesn't have the talent that it seems as though their points and their standing indicate.
Got the coach.
I know. Is it that simple sometimes?
Look at the roster last year. Not much of a change.
Right.
It's an attitude change. It's a way of play. It's the way the team's playing change. Obviously, the Leafs are just starting up against the Lightning here on TSN. And you know what, Drew? Carlisle is such a... And Michel Therrien's done a great job, by the way. Now, they may be fading, but he's done a great job. But coaching is the ultimate difference maker.
It's an equalizer.
And what Carlisle's done with this squad is he's come in, and I think it was a blessing last year that he got to be familiar with the roster without the expectation of them being any good. He saw what he needed to see, and he made the requisite changes coming into the season, and this team plays a lot differently. You can take issue with the toughness. You can take issue with this is happening and that's happening, and they're getting lucky. They're in fifth spot. They could be in fourth spot. They're in the playoffs. They've clinched for the first time since Daryl Sittler was skating down the left wing. And no matter what happens this year, the Leafs are going to have had a successful season. But one thing I like about Carlisle, amongst many other things, of course, is that he's not satisfied with this team getting in there. Not that any coach would necessarily be, but especially him. He's going to keep pushing this squad, and he's pushed players to levels that they hadn't been before, as far as I'm concerned, or he returned them to levels that they had been before, like Phaneuf.
Yeah, Richie, is it just a coincidence that Nazem Kadri is having his best year of his career? Is it any coincidence that Cody Franzen's having one of the best years of his career? Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a really good coach, and he should be, if not a Jack Adams Trophy candidate, he should be given strong consideration. He should be at the very least in the top five or six. But I don't think it's any coincidence. And you're right, Drew. If you look at the lineup after, you know, Phil Kessel and James Van Riemsdyk, and if you want to throw in Leupold and Phaneuf, they really aren't the most talented team. But if you look at how many goals they've scored, they're top 10 in the league. And if you look, they've got a great penalty kill. James Reimer's had a great year. And I'm not surprised now that they're competing for the Northeast, in the sense that Montreal's faded and Boston's faded without really putting the foot on the gas. But I am surprised, you know, looking back on the season as a whole, that they've made the playoffs. But when you consider that they've been there the whole year, it's not like the Leafs have just surged into a playoff spot. They've been in a playoff spot almost the whole year. So they've stayed there and they've played really well. And you have to give them full credit. Now, they might get a good matchup and they might not get a good matchup, but I'm pretty sure that they aren't just happy with making the playoffs. And as Richie mentioned, Carlisle is the type of guy, he's not just happy that they got there. He's got the playoff experience. He'd like to win a round or two, if not more.
People point to stats, and you can skew stats in every different way, and there's many that are valuable, and taken together they can have some meaning for sure. But, you know, they talk about being outshot, and they talk about this and that. One stat that I think is very important to maybe counteract the stats that have been used against the Maple Leafs is regulation and overtime wins. Do you guys know that the Maple Leafs have the third most regulation overtime wins in the entire National Hockey League?
Behind only Pittsburgh and Chicago. Pittsburgh, who's running away with that at 32 points, and the Blackhawks at 28 points. 28 regulation wins. But yeah, that is an indicator that they're not winning in a... I hate to call shootout wins cheap wins, but, you know, when you're winning in regulation or overtime, it's a more legitimate evaluation.
That's a more legitimate win.
Skill.
I mean, shootouts are a crapshoot, and maybe there's some skill over many
years.
Just
take the shoot out of that. They're crap.
But, I mean, you know...
Awkward silence there for a little bit. Well, everybody knows that I don't like the shootout, and I know that you guys, it's not your favorite thing, but, you know, it is a good stat. I mean, the Toronto Maple Leafs, you know, whether or not they're a surprise team, and, you know, we're going to get into this next segment when we talk about the Western Conference, but as far as the Columbus Blue Jackets and the New York Islanders go, most people did not have either of those teams in the playoffs, and now they're in the playoffs. So, you know, we can say it was a surprise, but we can also say that it wasn't a fluke. I mean, the Columbus Blue Jackets, sure, they're getting, you know, out of this world goaltending from Sergei Bobrovsky. But I don't think you can say that it's mainly goaltending for the Islanders or the Leafs. James Reimer's played awesome, and I think he's had an underrated season.
Mm-hmm.
But they also have players that can put the puck in the net. They've got some good defensemen. There's other reasons. Special teams are good. So, I mean, you got to give them credit. Whether or not you believe it or it was a surprise or not, I mean, they've earned their playoff spot. They've already clinched, and it was well-deserved.
And also, you know, you want to talk about the value of regulation overtime wins. The NHL would not use it as a determine whether or not a team should be, you know, advance the playoffs based upon using it as a main tiebreaker.
They wouldn't
use it as a main tiebreaker because it's the best indicator, at least as the league believes, of, you know, in terms of actual true team success.
All that being said, about praise to the Leafs and everybody else there in the East. Do you see anybody beating Pittsburgh?
I mean, Drew, do I see anybody beating Pittsburgh? It seems unlikely because they're the best team through and through. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they can't be beat. Obviously, playoffs is very matchup-based. We've talked about that a ton. And if the playoffs were to start today, I mean, the Rangers aren't an easy out. And if you go through the Rangers, maybe you have to draw Montreal in the next round, and then you have to draw Boston. So they're going to be the overwhelming favorite, I think. I think by the odds, they'll probably be one, and Chicago will be two. But there's health issues. I mean, can James Neal return from the concussion? What will Paul Martin be playing like as he returns from injury? Is Sidney Crosby in good enough to shape to play? And I think they're probably holding him out right now. But there's many factors, Drew. And that defense, you can get something against that defense. And Marc-Andre Fleury, I like the player. I think he's really good. I think he's athletic. He's been in the big games. But he's prone to crumble, see last year's playoffs. So are they unbeatable? I don't think so. But they are the favorite.
Absolutely. And if you listen back to the show last year, I'm pretty sure we all picked Pittsburgh. And, you know, it's sure they've added.
I took Philly.
I didn't.
I did. Threw me under the bus there.
Oh, did you? Okay. Well,
I get rounded enough for my bad predictions. So give me good ones once in a while.
The thing is, Richie, a year ago is a long time ago for me. A week ago, I can barely remember what I was doing.
I was going to say.
2 hours ago.
Most of us, you
forgot to wear pants today, so we really got to start. We got to start small.
All things considered, I don't think, you know, even if, you know, it's the Rangers we're talking about here, I don't think they present the same challenges as Philly. I think Pittsburgh can be beaten, and, you know, I'm probably going to pick Pittsburgh to win the Cup this year because of the additions they made. I probably would have picked them without the additions they made. But I would probably say that there are probably only two or three teams maybe in the East that can really cause them problems. And I would probably argue that even those teams can't beat Pittsburgh. You know, you just look at the guys they added, and I really think Ray Shiro knows what he's doing. I think this team is really good. But when you throw in Morrow and Aginla and Murray, I just really think that this team is made to win the Stanley Cup this year. But we'll get into that more. And, you know, last year we had, you know, a six seed in the East and an eight seed in the West in the Stanley Cup Finals.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, just because you're the number one seed doesn't mean as much as it used to, maybe.
Before we go to break, can we talk about the fact that Remus has been slurping that Slurpee cup? That annoying sound when you're slurping and the straw's touching the plastic cover?
Yeah.
Yeah, like you've been doing that all segment.
It is kind of annoying.
Folks, that wasn't a sound effect. That was actually Michael Remus.
Remus!
It's Slurpee season.
But it's, you know, we're on the air. It's kind of annoying in the background.
It's okay. I'm almost done, guys.
Let's go to break. You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. 20 minutes past 6 o'clock. Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Our Facebook is facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website is www.illegalcurve.com. Gentlemen, shifting our focus over to the Western Conference, it's a quiet night in the East, but it's a very big night in the West. The Detroit Red Wings.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't want to stumble on my words there. The Detroit Red Wings play tonight at home to the Los Angeles Kings. That game currently underway, or soon to be underway, I believe, on TSN 2.
6:30.
A game that the Detroit Red Wings have to leapfrog the Columbus Blue Jackets and get back into the playoff standings.
Yeah, this is their game in hand.
Yeah.
The Red Wings have a game in hand on Columbus. LA will not have Dustin Brown tonight. I'm going to talk about him in my three things I learned this week, because I thought that Shanny did a good job by suspending him.
Let me ask you that. Sorry for interrupting. Okay. You know, Dustin Brown gets suspended. Do you think Kyle Okposo should have got suspended for his hit on Bogosian?
I did, and I think that when we're talking about hits to the head, and especially hits to the head that result in injury, I think that should come into play. I think that's something that, you know, maybe we'll have the opportunity to talk about a little bit more after the regular season is over. I think injury plays a huge part in it, Richie. Does injury play a part in the legal system? Of course it does. And what I mean is, you know, the severity of an injury has a lot to do with the crime. And, you know, Kyle Okposo, you know, got away with one on Zach Bogosian, and Bogosian was injured on the play, and it was a hit to the head. Now, you know, whether the intent was there or not, which I believe it was, by the way, in that case and the case of Dustin Brown, then you're looking at more than a game or more than a fine. And I've watched the Dustin Brown hit many times. And, you know, you could argue that he could get 5 games for that. I mean, you know, the way Jason Palmenville, his head snaps back, I mean, that could be a serious injury here. And, you know, he's not a repeat offender, but, you know, that's up to, you know, more intelligent hockey people than me to decide. But, you know, yeah, I did think Okposo's hit was dirty.
I thought it was dirty, too. I mean, direct contact with the head. I'm not sure what the NHL is looking for here. I mean, I don't think it deserved 10 games.
No.
I thought it deserved a suspension. And again, you get to the point where with the National Hockey League, you don't know what suspension is going to be.
Right.
You know, they have to be, it has to be consistent. I've talked about this so many times. Yep. And I don't want to go on and on about this because I find it really boring, frankly. But if you're going to be hitting, if you have a contact to the head, and I believe there it was shoulder to the chin.
Yeah.
Direct contact to the head, and you're worried about concussions and eventually liability, if not sooner rather than later, you want to at least suspend him and make sure the players are safe. I guess the question really is, do you want Bogosian on the ice or do you want hits like that in the game? I mean, I boil it down. It's not that simple, but I do boil it down to that, and I think you really should be suspending the player, maybe for 1 or 2 games. I didn't think it was absolutely an egregious error, but I thought it was an oversight.
Well, that's something. I mean, contact to the head. In the course of the game, when it's happening at real-time speed, it's hard to know. You might miss a couple of those. Mm-hmm. But if you make it a complete black-and-white issue where, after the fact, when you looked at all the replays and it's completely, you know, boom, he hit him in the head, accidentally or not, doesn't matter, the guy gets a suspension. If the NHL just implements that and takes the gray out of the equation, why isn't the game better off for that?
The one problem you have there, Drew, is if a guy comes up the middle and you just smoke him, you do everything textbook. You don't leave your feet. You go shoulder to basically chest/chin.
I mean, in the NFL nowadays, I mean, they've changed what a legal tackle is.
And why do you think they've changed?
Because of concussions.
Right. Because of liability, not because of liability.
I mean,
no, Richie's right, though.
Right, if there's no liability, then it's not an issue.
And I thought that Jared Cowan's hit on Jeff Skinner was clean. And a lot of people on Twitter were saying that it was a hit to the head. But, and again, Drew, I know
Quickly, Jared Cowan's like 6'5", and Skinner's like 5'8".
Exactly. So, again, we're not going to get into a sprawling debate here about fighting and all that, but I think that body checking and fighting can play a role in hockey, and I think it can play a role that doesn't result in more concussions. And I think that, you know, when I think there, you can take, you know, I mean, these guys are huge. I mean, the average player in the NHL is 6'2", 210 pounds. There are going to be concussions. It's just a rough physical game. That's the way it's going to be. But I think the cheap shots, you can really take out, and you can set a precedent when you suspend these guys. Look at who was involved here. I mean, you know, Dustin Brown almost won the Conn Smythe Trophy last year. Jason Palmenville is one of the top mm-hmm. offensive player. You're talking about, you know, guys that are on the first lines of their respective teams. So when you suspend a guy, I think that sends more of a message than if you suspend, no offense to Jared Cowan, but if you were to suspend Jared Cowan, I guess that's a bad example because Jeff Skinner was involved. But the point being that when you have a top player like Dustin Brown, captain of his team, when, you know, you suspend a guy like that, I think it does resonate.
Dustin Brown always plays on the edge. I mean, every play, every kind of hit he makes is kind of pretty close. So I'm not shocked to see him finally get harpooned by Shanahan.
Right. You made the comment about the size difference. To me, that you know, they never factor in size difference when they talk about high sticking. A player has to be responsible for his stick at all times, regardless of if the guy that
that's
he's
a good point.
High sticking is a lot smaller than him, or if the guy that he's high sticking is a lot shorter than
but
him.
But Drew, like when you're high sticking, they're generally like you're turning around and it just happens to hit the face, no matter where it is, or you're trying to lift the stick and it goes up. I don't think that's analogous necessarily. If a player is a textbook hit and it happens to be in the guy's chin and he doesn't do anything wrong, that's just the way it is. I'm sorry, I don't have an issue with that. This hit, though, Okposo's a little bit shorter than, he's built like a truck, but he's a little bit shorter than the Mogosian. Mogosian's head's a little bit down, but it's shoulder to chin. Even a penalty, there was no penalty even on the play.
And I'm more okay with no penalty being called because they don't have the opportunity to look back and make that call. It's happening in real time. Things happen in real time.
I don't know. In real time, I thought that was a penalty. I didn't think it was even a question.
Okay. I don't think it was a question. It definitely was a penalty, but I can understand missing something in real time a lot more than I can understand not suspending them after the fact when you've had the opportunity to look at it from a number of different angles.
I think the best point you made, Drew, was about the gray area. And I have a little bit of gray hair in my sideburns, so I know what I'm talking about here. Maybe I should get Just for Men. But the point that you made, about the gray area is true. I mean, when they break down these penalties, Richie, and they say, okay, the guy's taller, you know, the angle he was coming in, okay, that's fine and dandy. But at the end of the day, if it's a dirty hit, it's a dirty hit. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many different criteria, and I actually love how the NHL Department of Player Safety and Shanny release these videos. I think they break it down in a very clear and concise way, even for the average hockey fan, you know, who isn't, you know, analyzing these things from four different angles. But at the end of the day, if a guy hits someone else in the head, and especially if it results in a concussion, the guy gets suspended, period. No gray area.
That's my point. Just eliminate the gray area on the suspension.
I don't like that because...
Well, then you continue to have the situation here where sometimes you hit a guy in the head and it's a suspension and sometimes you don't.
If you text...
And how do you know someone's intention?
It's a case-by-case basis. I don't like the black and white rule.
Why not? Just black and white. I'm not saying black and white is for 10
what
games.
What about the black and white cookie?
That's a different
story. You get fined. In the NFL, if a guy gets hit in the helmet, and if it's a helmet-to-helmet hit, intention or no intention...
Yeah, but it's not every helmet-to-helmet hit. If a
helmet-to-helmet hit gets a fine, practically.
No, not if you're running the ball.
Well, you're right. In that instance, you're allowed, but not anymore. You can't. The running back can no longer lower his head. They've changed the rule there.
You can't lower your head, but you can still hit him in the helmet if you're a defender.
Yeah, in some respects.
So... I mean, it's case by case, Drew. I just thought that particular case, it should have been a penalty or at least a penalty and probably a one game suspension. I don't need a 10 game suspension. I didn't think that was a completely, absolutely careless and reckless hit.
I thought it was.
You got in the game, he hit him a little bit in the chin, and you know, you need to just account for that. But I don't want I hate when they rush to judgment about certain things. I actually applaud the NHL this way in that they're not just suddenly putting in rules like black and white. The NFL is trying to institute a lot of things, and I'm not so sure their intention is all there. And maybe the NFL, as a complete aside, maybe they should institute drug testing more strictly than all these head hits. That might be might be able to fix some of their problems.
Let's leave it there. That was supposed to be about the Western Conference playoffs. We'll get to that a little bit later in the show, obviously. When we come back, Pat Hickey of the Montreal Gazette is going to join us. You're listening to NHL Midweek on TSN 1290. In the evening, welcome back to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website is www.illegalcurve.com.
The TSN 1290 NHL Midweek Hotline.
We welcome back to NHL Midweek our good friend from the Montreal Gazette, Pat Hickey. Pat, good evening. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good evening, guys.
Pat, you know, we got to start. Obviously, the Habs are here tomorrow playing the Jets in a definitely a must-win game for the Jets. A little bit less so for the Habs, but still an important game for them. You know, start with their recent struggles. You know, is it just a sort of a blip? You know, a sign of some sort of, you know, almost end of season doldrums after they've clinched a playoff spot, or is it something more troubling that's affecting the Montreal Canadiens?
Yeah, well, I'd like to think it's a blip. I think Montreal fans would like to think it's a blip, but the longer this slump that they're in goes on, the more difficult it seems to be. You know, we're in a situation right now where they've lost five of their last six games. The goaltending isn't playing where the goaltending isn't very good. The offense is staggered. The defense has just been terrible. The PK hasn't been very good for most of the year. They had a stretch where they won 7 or 8 games without giving up a goal, but now all of a sudden they seem to have gone back to form. They had 2 scored against them last night, and basically they're just not playing very good hockey.
Pat, you mentioned the goaltending earlier. Carey Price hasn't played that well. Is everybody really getting excited about nothing? I mean, once the playoffs start, are we going to see the Carey Price that we've all come to love and respect?
Well, again, I mean, the Canadians are hoping that's the case. It was interesting that Serge Savard was on radio in Montreal this afternoon and expressed no in certain terms that, you know, he wasn't very happy with the way that you know, Carey was playing. Now, of course, he doesn't have any official capacity with the team, but he does have the owner's ear. He helped sign the new general manager. So, you know, when he says something like that, you can probably figure that the people in the front office aren't very happy either. His goals against average, close to 5 over the last 7 games. He's only won 1 game, and he's 4-9 now in his last 13 starts. And that's certainly not what you're looking for going into the playoffs.
Pat, in terms of Michel Therrien, he obviously was, we talked, you know, with you before about his first tenure as coach of the Canadiens, and we've seen in, you know, throughout many documentaries and just, you know, from our point of view, coaches take different angles in terms of team struggles. You know, sometimes they're hard on the team and then they lay off a little bit, or they show panic, or they don't. What's been his approach during these recent struggles?
He's been very calm. You know, he's you know, hasn't yelled at them, hasn't had a bag skate or anything like that. He's given them some time off. When that didn't work, I mean, they did have a day off canceled on Sunday and had some extra practice because he wasn't happy with what they were, you know, with the performance on the ice. So, you know, I think he's convinced that they have time to get it back together again before the playoffs start. Now, you know, one of the things, he's expecting a good performance tomorrow night in Winnipeg, and then, of course, you're in a situation where they play, finish the season in Toronto. Now, depending upon how Toronto does in Florida, that could be a very important game. Home ice could be up at stake if the Canadiens don't win tomorrow night in Winnipeg.
You know, you mentioned home ice, Pat. Are people in Montreal starting to chatter a lot about the possibility of Habs Leafs for the first time in many, many years?
Oh, I think that's been all people have talked about for the last week and a half, probably. It, you know, looked like it was going to be Montreal 4-5. The funny thing is that, you know, Boston has not played well. I think they're 1-4-1 in their last 6 games. Left the door open for the Canadiens to clinch that number 2, you know, to move into that number 2 spot. But the Canadiens haven't played any better. In fact, they played worse. So, you know, there's certainly a lost opportunity there. You can say that, you know, they're satisfied that they, you know, clinched the playoff spot early. But you would think that they'd want to push a little harder, and they certainly have things to play for.
You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. We're joined by Pat Hickey of the Montreal Gazette. Pat, you know, the Canadiens' losing streak sort of started, you know, give or take around the 9th or so of April. That's when they lost to Washington, and they've only won twice in the 7 games since then. You know, Hamlin underwent season-ending knee surgery on the 8th of April. Is there any correlation between the losing streak and Hamlin's going down with injury, or is that just sort of a happenstance?
No, it's very definitely a correlation because, you know, this is a team that's not very big, not very physical. And Yemlin was one of the few guys that go out there and hit people. And, you know, one of the things Rennie Bork was talking about last night, he said, we're getting out hit in almost every game. And Yemlin's you know, presence out there, it means that everybody on the depth chart has got to go down a spot. They've got Yannick Weber, who's only played, I think, 5 games all season. Mm-hmm. Now playing, you know, last night he started off as one of their top 4 defensemen. And he's just not equipped for that, and certainly a very different defenseman than Alexis Yemelin. Whereas Yemelin was a physical player, Yannick Weber is all finesse, offensive player, and not very big. So, you know, there's not much of a trade-off there. And, You know, they've had, Jared Tinhorty was up for a while, and Nathan Beaulieu, but they've decided that the kids just don't have the experience that they need out there, and it'll be interesting to see whether they get, you know, to the point where, you know, they might actually dress Thomas Cabaret, and they don't want to do that because they don't want to run the risk of him getting hurt so they can't buy him out at the end of the season.
You mentioned Jared Tinhorty, and the Habs recalled him from Hamilton. Would you expect him to see him in the lineup against Winnipeg tomorrow? And
No, he's not. He's not even in Winnipeg. All those guys they called up won't actually be with the team until the weekend. You know, they've been called up, but none of them are actually on the on the roster. If they played them, you know, if they called them up and played them, they would have to pay them for the last couple of games. So they don't want to do that, and they don't really feel these guys can help them. This is basically a call-up to give them some extra bodies in practice during the playoffs and to take a look at some of these guys and make some judgments based going forward, you know, on what they need in the draft and what they might need during the offseason. Just a chance to look at these guys up close and see what they can do.
Pat, the Habs have had a rough couple of weeks here. They've only won 4 of their last 10 games, and, you know, we've already talked about it. They're on a slide, but they're still in contention for the second seed in the Eastern Conference. What are the internal expectations of the Montreal Canadiens? Is this a team that actually thinks that they can win the Cup? Because obviously making the playoffs is pretty good based on the fact they didn't last year.
Well, I think that, you know, the philosophy, and most teams have this, is you make the playoffs and then anything can happen. But certainly any expectations they have to be dimmed considering the way they're playing lately. It appears, you know, that maybe they're satisfied making the playoffs. I think fans are hoping that's not the case, and we'll have to see. But if they can't win, you know, at least one of these last two games, and if they can't play well in both of the games, then I don't see where they're going to have too much expectation, you know. Teams talk about turning the button on and off, but it just doesn't work that way. And they have to show something better than what they've done so far.
And the Leafs just scored, Pat, so they're up 1-0 in Tampa right now. About the Leafs, and I watched a little bit of the film in terms of the Habs and how they've been playing recently. Pat, it seems like they really get worked over a lot on the boards, and maybe their lack of size, especially up front. Is that a big issue if they play the Maple Leafs, who are pretty big on that back end?
Well, it has been an issue so far when they played the Leafs. I mean, they've lost 3 of the 4 games they played, and they've been manhandled. They were manhandled by Philadelphia. They don't have to worry about the Flyers in the playoffs, but those are the kind of teams that give them trouble. And so I don't think they want to play them. They don't particularly want to play the New York Islanders, another team that, you know, played them very physical and gave them a lot of trouble.
In terms of the short season, Pat, you know, the Habs obviously peaked really early. If this had been, this is obviously hypothetical, but if this had been an 82-game season, do you see this team, do you think this team would have taken the same course and kind of faded away, or do you think they would have stayed strong?
I think they would have stayed strong. I think they would have approached things differently, and, there would have been some things. Of course, if they had an 82-game season, for example, Alex Galchenyuk wouldn't have been with the team. There's a guy that's in the conversation. I don't think he's a rookie of the year, but he's certainly in the conversation for that award. But he wouldn't have been with the team if they had played an 82-game season.
It's an interesting point. In terms of their trade deadline acquisitions, obviously it was limited to really Davis Drewski. They acquired Michael Ryder a little bit before that for Eric Cole. How has he fit in? I mean, obviously he was playing almost 20 minutes a couple nights ago, and he only played 9 last night, but he's been playing pretty significant minutes overall. What's been his performance?
I'm sorry, who is this?
Davis Drewski.
Well, you know, it's again, he's a physical player, but I he's a 5'6 guy. He has had a couple of games where he's played big minutes. He's also had a couple of games where he's been in a healthy scratch. So I don't think, either way, he hasn't, he's not really, he's more of a spare part than a pickup. They brought him in for insurance, and that's exactly what he is.
You're listening to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. We're joined by Pat Hickey of the Montreal Gazette. Pat, if you had to choose one, Is it P.K. Subban for the Norris, Brendan Gallagher for the Calder, or Michelle Therrien for the Jack Adams?
Well, I think all three of them have a shot. I think Subban probably has the best bet, winning the Norris. I think that he's just gotten better as the season went on. He's having a tremendous season, and the fact that he's gotten all those points will certainly help with the voters. And personally, I think Gallagher is near the top of my list on Rookie of the Year choices, but I don't think enough people have seen him. And again, you look at numbers and you look at some of the other guys that are around there. I think they'll get consideration before he does. Therrien, I think he's got a shot for Coach of the Year, but I think there's probably some other guys. Randy Carlisle, for example, has done a pretty good job. Of course, the Canadians have come from further back than anybody else. The one thing that might hurt him a little bit is the fact that, this is a team that, 2 years ago and 3 years ago, played very well in the playoffs, and everybody looked at last year as an aberration.
Pat, we talked about some of the teams that the Habs might play in the first round, whether it's the Islanders or the Leafs, but as far as the Habs go how far they go, if you're able to give us maybe one reason why you think the Habs could get past the first round and possibly, get even to the Eastern Conference Finals or the Stanley Cup Finals, and then maybe a reason why the Habs are a candidate to get knocked out in the first round.
Well, I think the answer to both questions is Carey Price. if Carey Price plays well, goaltenders loom large in the playoffs, and if Carey Price plays well, they've got a good shot. The problem is that Carey Price doesn't have a lot of playoff success, and I think that's one of the things that they don't have going for them in the playoffs.
Pat Hickey of the Montreal Gazette, thank you as always for joining us this evening on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We look forward to it each and every time.
Anytime, guys.
Thanks, Pat. Take care. Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. 10 minutes before the top of the hour, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to our friend Pat Hickey for joining us. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available both on illegalcurve.com and tsn1290.ca. While you're at it, you can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Break it down.
Weekly Break It Down segment is going to focus on the Montreal Canadiens power play. Obviously, they will be in Winnipeg tomorrow night to play the Jets in the final Jets home game of the year, a game you can hear live on TSN 1290. Puck drop tomorrow night, 7 p.m. The Habs power play is dangerous, fourth in the NHL at 21.2%. Obviously a good percentage and much better than what the Winnipeg Jets have put on the ice in terms of the power play this year. You look at the Habs' strength, and with unit number one, Richie, and would you agree with me that the strength starts with Andre Markov and P.K. Subban at the back end?
Absolutely. I don't think any team, Richie, has a better 1-2 punch on defense than the Montreal Canadiens. Remember back in the day they had Mark Strait, who's now on the New York Islanders. We talked about him a little bit on Saturday when we were previewing the Islanders-Jets game. But P.K. Subban and Andre Markov are so athletic. They've both got great shots, and they're also extremely mobile. They can move that puck better than anybody, I think. And I really think that, that's really what drives the power play. And you look at the Montreal Canadiens last year, and this isn't just on the power play, but it's also, overall. No Andre Markov last year, and the Habs really struggled. But I think it does start with P.K. Subban and Andre Markov, and I think they've got other talented players on the ice as well. I think Brian Gionta's the type of guy that's a little bit underrated on the power play. But on defense, absolutely. Those guys are, I think, better than anybody else.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have a left-handed shooter and a right-handed shooter. You have guys who can both pass, who can both shoot, and are both pretty mobile, Subban being exceptionally mobile. Their power play does run from the back end, and they've strategized in such a way that it does run from that end, rightfully so. There are some teams who don't necessarily set up a power play based upon the skill level and the strength of their roster, and I think Montreal does it quite well.
when you talk about them, like you said, we've in the course of doing this segment, we've discussed a number of different power play setups. You would describe this one as it's the quote-unquote the slot set power play?
There's many different names for the kind of the same thing. But yeah, what you see with the power play with the Habs is Subban and Markov are their number one unit. They'll play interchangeably with this first or second unit on the back on the up front. Excuse me.
You're saying the forwards? There's no clear cut number one power play unit in terms of the forwards.
There is, but these defensemen will play a significant period of time. You know, with both units. The first unit is Plekanec, Gionta, and Ryder. That's predominantly what they use as their first unit, at least lately, and certainly against New Jersey two nights ago. So what you'll see is Markov and Subban will line up across the blue line, and what they'll try to do is switch sides, and by that I mean they'll play on their off wings, so it's easier to have a one-timer coming from the half boards. And what you see on their setup is Ryder will set up on that. Let's do it this way. They try and funnel the power play through the defensemen, as we mentioned, Subban and Markov, as well as Plekanec on the first unit in terms of forwards. Plekanec will set up on the half boards, on his off wing, like most really strong puck handlers who are pretty good passers do. And the power play will work through there. Gionta will kind of be in the corner. Now he'll move to the front if the puck's at the top of the blue line. And then you'll see Michael Ryder pop into the slot, mid-slot approximately, and on his off wing. So meaning he's in the slot when Plekanec has a puck on the right side. And so it's easier for him to take the shot on the goalie. Ryder has an exceptionally quick release. He's got a really good wrist shot. So he is pretty dangerous, and he's been a nice addition because Eric Cole really isn't a power play player, and that's not his strength. So Ryder will set up there. Now, Gionta is a smaller player, and he's not a left-handed shooting guy. So if you kind of picture like Ribeiro or Backstrom, left-handed shooting players playing in the corner kind of as passers, he's a right-handed shooting guy. So a lot of the time he'll get the puck, and he'll move towards the net, and he'll use the net kind of as a screen, and he'll try and pick either Ryder in the slot, Plekanec coming into the slot, or one of the defensemen at the point who are either cutting or who are at the blue line.
It seems to me that there isn't a great net presence on any, given the smaller stature of the Canadiens' forwards.
No, and out of the four or five forwards that we've mentioned, Richie, or six, Michael Ryder's the biggest guy. He's not the most overly physical. He's obviously a big guy. But, Richie, I think you'd agree, as far as the Montreal Canadiens' power play goes, when you say that, you know, the power play flows through P.K. Subban and Andre Markov, mm-hmm. we don't just mean that, you know, they're setting it up from the point or they have the big shots. They control, you know, where the forwards go. And I think you'd agree that they're almost so good at their skating ability is so good. They almost act as forwards on the point. And what I mean by that is they're able to fake a shot, and they're also able to beat guys mm-hmm. one-on-one. And it's funny, they don't necessarily have that big guy in the front, but Plekanec and Gionta both have the ability to be playmakers, and they're smaller, and they're able to move from in and out of the slot onto the half boards and create room. And what I like, too, is P.K. Subban is the guy, he's gotten better at not always pinching. He's gotten a mm-hmm. lot smarter. I don't think he gets enough credit for that. He used to pinch way more early on in his career.
On that point, if you watch the power play a lot, Subban's actually kind of the anchor on the blue line. Markov is the one who roams in the slot a lot.
Roams like Lubomir Vyshnovsky does for the Islanders?
More? Markov's all over the ice. He's in the mid-slot. He's in the right side. He's in the left side. He really comes down. And he's not always in shooting position. It's interesting. He'll kind of put himself in a quasi-receiving the pass, like kind of back to the net in the slot even, and he'll make another play off of that, either turning and shooting or making a pass. Markov just tries to draw people to him. He's a smart player, really cerebral. And it's a really interesting power play because of the ability of all their players generally to move the puck. But if you're the Winnipeg Jets, and as an aside, I thought the Jets did a really nice job of defending Washington's 1-3-1 yesterday, kind of throwing Burmistrov onto Ovechkin and taking away that shot. I thought Washington had trouble adjusting to that.
Way down in the corner, if you saw that third period power play mm-hmm. that the Caps had, you almost couldn't see Ovechkin and Burmistrov on the screen because they were so deep in the corner there.
Yeah, that's exactly what they were doing. And I think so. In terms of strategy tomorrow night, when the Habs are playing the Jets in the final game of the season, if you're playing against the top unit, which we're mentioning right now, and we'll quickly touch on the second unit in a little bit, you kind of want to have the power play flow through Ryder on the opposite side of the ice, because Ryder's strength is shooting. It's not in passing and handling the puck necessarily. So if you can have the power play flow from the left side, not the right side, when that line's on the ice, then you have Subban, who's not in the off-wing one-timer's position, and you take away his huge shot. He has a huge shot. And you take away kind of Ryder being the shooter, and that's where you probably want the power play to flow. But it's not the easiest to necessarily to do that.
If you had to, and I don't know if this question can be answered, is there one guy on the Habs power play that you don't want beating you?
No, I thought about that. That's a good question, Drew. I don't think so. I mean, this team doesn't have a lot of size, but they have a lot of guys who can move the puck. You know, Plekanec can move the puck. Subban can move it. Markov can move it. Gionta can move it. Go to the next unit. Desharnais can move it. Weber, you know, who Pat Hickey just spoke about, he can move the puck. I mean, he can't defend very well, but he can move the puck. And the other guys they have on their roster who they're playing, you know, Pat Chiaretti, more of a shooter than a passer, but this team's is deep, and they have a lot of players who you could say are kind of the same, but they're all skilled. And when they're skilled, it's harder to kind of target one rather than the other.
And Markov isn't a guy that you can just take away his shot and you're going to limit him. He's such an intelligent player, mm-hmm. and his skating ability, really, I've already said it, but it really is impressive. If anything, if there's one guy to look out for on the first power play unit, it would be Ryder, you know, who Richie already talked about, because he's got such a good shot, and you think, oh, because he's a slower guy, you might be able to, you know, take away the, you know, the point shots, or maybe Plekanec's ability to shoot. There's a reason why a power play can be effective. And, you know, it also sounds easy, but watching Montreal twice here and their power play, another thing that they do that Washington does is their decision-making is so quick, and the yeah. passes that they make are so much more organized and purposeful than the Winnipeg Jets. I mean, it really, a power play is really an art. We've said that before on the show, but it really is. And if you look at the guys that they have out there, they really make quick decisions and quick passes and really know where to be at the right time. And even if they don't get a goal, they seem to always have the right formation in place. And it seems like, okay, you get a power play, you put these guys out there, you're going to do the same thing. There's no real you know, worry that it's going to come back and hurt you. But when you look at who's out there, there isn't too many guys that you can't focus in on.
Are the Jets better off pressuring the puck handlers against the Habs power play? Or are they best off sort of standing back and setting and staying in a tight box formation?
Yeah, probably the latter, Drew, because of the puck movement and the speed. If you start chasing, you're really going to be in trouble because they have a couple of guys who can really let it go from the blue line.
So discipline is important.
Discipline is important, and if you can outman them on the, not necessarily outman on the PK, but if you can get even guys, you know, two on two behind the net, they don't have a lot of size. Gionta battles. Brendan Gallagher on the second unit will battle. Desharnais and Plekanec a little bit less so, but they're not big, so you can get that puck off them and fire it down, but you have to get it on the boards in the first place.
You can watch for that tomorrow. Jets Habs 7 p.m. puck drop here on TSN 1290. Let's go to break. You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Go. Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. Still to come on the program next segment, Andrew Gross is going to join us. He covers the New York Rangers for the Record newspaper in Jersey. Right now, we're going to tell you six things we learned this week.
Six things we learned this week.
Commence countdown. Six.
Richard Pollock, we'll start with you on this Wednesday evening. The additions of Rafi Torres and Scott Hannon have suitably replaced Douglas Murray and Ryan Clough and concurrently helped add some draft picks to a poor San Jose Sharks prospect system.
That's exactly it, Drew. I mean, you're looking at two players. Torres essentially replaces Ryan Clough, and Scott Hannon replaces Doug Murray. And in the process, you've added a bunch of second-round picks, draft picks, and you've helped replenish a system that really has been depleted since the Brent Burns trade, excuse me. I like this trade for any reasons. I kind of thought, that's what I had said at the time, that the Jets should have done for Hainsey. I mean, trade him if you can get a second-round pick, and trade for a guy like Hannon, who's not much of a drop-off, for a sixth or whatever it costs him, sixth or a seventh, I forget right now. But the idea is, you know, what is Scott Hannon? He's more of a stay-at-home defenseman, not the best skater. He has an edge. And what's Doug Murray? The same. What's Rafi Torres? I mean, doesn't have necessarily the skill that Ryan Clough does, but he can hit. He had a nice goal last night. Can do many of the same things. He's more of an up and down guy. And what do? You're able to add these players, keep an eye on the future, and not really have a drop off. And I think Doug Wilson, who I really do think has hung on too long with this core, you do have to give him credit for being aggressive in that way. And I will qualify that by saying it's a lot easier to be aggressive with your fringe core players than it is to be aggressive with your core players. But overall, I think it's a job well done.
Ezra Ginsberg, if the Toronto Maple Leafs end up facing the Montreal Canadiens in the first round, they will have a great chance at upsetting them because of their speed and physicality.
Okay, I want everyone to relax first and foremost because I'm not jumping on the Toronto Maple Leafs bandwagon. So, you know, everybody who's listening and that just, you know, spit up their orange juice, I want you to relax for a second. But
who's drinking orange juice right now?
Yeah, exactly. It's a little bit late for orange juice, Richie. That's right. People should be drinking beer or hot chocolate. but the fact of the matter is the Toronto Maple Leafs have defeated the Montreal Canadiens three times this year. And they haven't just beaten... Richie's, you know, losing his mind here.
I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
I don't know either. So the fact of the matter is they've won three or four games, okay? And they just beat them less than 2 weeks ago, 5-1 on Hockey Night in Canada. Everybody remembers that. But the Toronto Maple Leafs, guys, in every single game they've played the Montreal Canadiens, have been outshot, and James Reimer has played very well.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a fast team, and we've seen that in Winnipeg twice, and we've seen that against the Montreal Canadiens. So I'm not necessarily, you know, gonna say that the Toronto Maple Leafs are a guarantee to win the first round. But what I am saying, from watching the Toronto Maple Leafs enough this year, is that they have enough speed, both on defense and on forward, and they've proven it against the Montreal Canadiens not once, not twice, but thrice, that they can beat them. And you know, if they end up playing 4-5, Habs versus mm-hmm. Leafs, I think the Leafs match up really well. And it's not just because of the three wins, but it's because they've got the physicality, they've got yeah. speed. They're a better team than they were last year. And I think that's going to be a long series. It's not going to be a, you know, a 4 or 5 game series for Montreal.
Richard Pollock with a note about the Sedins.
Well, you know, I read an article, I think it was the Globe and Mail, about how the Sedins have been playing, you know, tougher competition this year based on Gabe Desjardins, a friend of ours, stats about Corsi, and we don't need to get all into that. They've been playing against better competition. And you know what? My response to that is, yeah, about time.
Well, I was going to say.
I know that they've been employing Ryan Kessler against the other team's best players and all that, and Kessler's really good two-way center. But you know what? And I know they've employed Sedins in more of an offensive role, and Malhotra, when he didn't have the eye injury, in a defensive role, the faceoffs. That's been written about ad nauseum 13 different ways. But let's call this what it is here. I mean, Wayne Gretzky, when he played, I mean, aside from playing against, you know, Steve Kasper at times and, you know, Guy Carbon in the 93 playoffs, he went up against the best players in the other team a lot of the time, and he beat them, and he beat them down. And so for the Sedins to play against the other team's top competition and best players and play well, I mean, should I be surprised about that, or should I expect that? Should Remus expect to have to press the button?
Ezzie Ginsberg, Ryan Johansson has shown flashes that he can be a future number two center for the Columbus Blue Jackets.
Flashes. Ryan Johansson, was drafted fourth overall before who, you ask? Jeff Skinner. He was drafted three spots ahead of Jeff Skinner. Now, he's only got 12 points in 38 games. Interesting note here is Ryan Johansson was actually sent down to the AHL earlier this season.
Surprised it's not after you talked about him.
Absolutely.
the Ezzie Ginsberg, the kiss of death for every NHL player.
Absolutely. He's a guy that I've always watched with a lot of interest. He put up big numbers in the dub with Portland. And he's a guy that he's not overly physical. He hasn't transitioned maybe as quickly as obviously Jeff Skinner, who won the Calder Trophy. But he's a guy who got the game-winning goal on Sunday night for Columbus. And his game is really starting to come around, Richie. And he's a guy that, you know, on a good team, I think you would argue that he wouldn't be a second-line center. But I think he's taken the next step this year. And he started off the season really poorly. I have it here. He had 2 points in his first 12 games. So he had a horrible start. But the entire Blue Jackets team had a horrible start. He's starting to come around a little bit. I think that game-winning goal was really nice. And he's a guy that, you know, at 21 years old, I think his future is really bright, and you can see that he's starting to develop into a good NHLer. So that was something I noticed about the Blue Jackets.
Yeah, and no question about his skill, is he? I mean, you know, can he put it all together? There's,
absolutely,
there's
yeah.
some questions there, but yeah. that's he's always been drafted. He was drafted based on potential.
Yep.
So let's see if he can
finally drafted,
reach that.
He was drafted. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Richard Pollock, in the offseason, the Columbus Blue Jackets and the Ottawa Senators made a trade, Nick Foligno for Mark Methot. It's been a good trade for both teams.
Yeah, you know, you want to declare winners and losers a lot of the time, and that's the culture that we're in. But I think in this particular situation, if you look at Columbus's defense, it's really the strength of their organization. They felt they had enough depth to trade Mathot eventually, you know, Jarmo Kekäläinen trading John Moore, and they still have Ryan Murray coming through the system and other players. So, and David Savard, who's not as widely regarded as Ryan Murray. But the idea is, you know, what did Columbus need? Columbus needed some grit up front. Columbus needed some speed, some experience. I mean, Foligno is an experienced player at this point. And who do they have to give? Well, they had really left-side defensemen. You know, they have guys who can, you know, Tootin, and they have, obviously, they acquired Tim Erickson and all that stuff. Don't remember the exact timeline there. But the point is, Mathot was dispensable for them. And he's come to Ottawa, and he's filled Philip Kuba's role, and frankly, he's been better than Philip Kuba. He's done a really nice job quietly in Ottawa. You know, a lot of the headlines go to Silverberg and guys who have progressed, Zibanejad, and obviously possibly with Carlson coming back, playing with Mathot on Thursday. But he just does his job. Simple plays, can be tough, long stick, solid defensively. It's exactly what Ottawa needed, and he's provided that. Conversely, you look at Foligno. If you watch Columbus play, he is very much, people talk about Dubinsky a lot. He's more effective as far as I'm concerned. He pressures the puck better. He's had better production. Dubinsky's had a tough year offensively, and Foligno hasn't scored 50 goals. But he does a lot of things. He gets in the dirty areas. Ottawa had some of those players to give away because they kind of had a lot of players who were similar in some respects. Columbus takes him, and he's been a godsend, really, for them. And you watch the way you watch Columbus play, and he's always involved, and he can do the little things. Is he a bit of a tweener at times? Maybe in terms of third or second line, but he fits in well. And he can maybe develop into a nice second liner, and he certainly has character. Probably got a lot of that from his dad. And I give both general managers, obviously Scott Housen's now been relieved of his duties as an over in Edmonton, but I give Brian Murray credit. He's done a great job, Brian Murray. And I give both and Housen credit for a trade that fits both teams' needs and has proved to be successful for both organizations.
Before we get to the last thing, you know, do you think we're going to get to the point in time where we ever stop immediately trying to declare a winner or a loser in every single trade?
No. I mean, lots of times there are winners or losers, but lots of times there also aren't winners or losers. So, I mean, you know, Drew, if you look at certain trades, you'll say, oh, this team got host. And sometimes that happens. I mean, if you look at the Florida Marlins trade in Toronto, I mean, with the Blue Jays, what are you going to say, or Miami Marlins, excuse me, you're going to say they probably got hosed, they sold the team. But, and there's always two different perspectives. But and also, if there was no winners or losers, what the heck would we talk about?
One.
By the way, this Kevin Wheeler ad's on again?
It's on TSN 2.
It's on TSN 2?
Yeah.
Who is this guy?
That's the great... Ezzy is on the case of to find out who Kevin Wheeler is, and apparently by finding out, that just means incessantly tweeting at him until he blocks you.
He blocked him?
Well, no, I assume he's eventually, if Ezzy keeps up with that barrage of tweets at him like he did yesterday.
Drew, that's not my third thing I learned this week. Can we get to it, please?
Please go ahead. It has to do with Dustin Brown and being suspended.
I think Shanny got it right, and, you know, you could argue that Brendan Shanahan should have suspended Dustin Brown for maybe 3 to 5 games, but I was going to get pretty upset if Dustin Brown wasn't suspended at all. I think if you look at it from the reverse angle, almost the crowd angle, you can really see that he looks up and he raises his elbow and makes direct contact with the head. And, you know, we were talking about it earlier, Richie. This is one of those cases where it really does set a precedent. And I think it's really important specifically because it's before the playoffs start. And Dustin Brown was a guy who almost won the Conn Smythe Trophy last year. And I think it does matter that it's him and not another player. I think it you know, sets the tone for the playoffs. So, you know, even though I would have been fine if he went 3 or 4 games, you know, because it's Dustin Brown, 2 games without pay, it's going to affect a guy like him as opposed to a fourth liner. But just by the nature of it, because it was that little bit of a gray area, and I think they took it for what it was, and Pominville's injured. We don't know how severely he's injured, but I really do think they got it right.
Before we go to break and bring in Andrew Gross of The Record, he covers the New York Rangers, a quick score update from around the NHL. Of course, it's a night off for scoreboard watching for Jets fans, as the only game that takes place in the Eastern Conference is Toronto at Tampa Bay, neither of which concern Winnipeg Jets fans. 5 minutes or so into the second period, the Leafs lead the Tampa Bay Lightning by a 1-0 margin. Leafs need the win in order to try and keep pace and maybe somehow sneak in and, as the Northeast Division champion. In Detroit, a far more important game when it comes to the Western Conference. L.A. at Detroit, it's scoreless with about 2 minutes to go in the first period. Actually, Tampa has just tied it up against the Leafs. Looks like Steven Stamkos got the goal. Still to come tonight, Chicago at Edmonton and San Jose at Phoenix. A game that Phoenix is desperate to hang on to the last. No, I think they've actually been mathematically eliminated at this point in time.
San Jose still needs that win, though. They want to try and get home ice advantage in the first round.
That's right. San Jose and LA are battling for fourth, fifth in the Western Conference. But LA Detroit is the most important game of the night. You can watch that on TSN 2. Let's go to break. You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. In the evening. Welcome back to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Michael Remus is our producer and doing a fabulous job at it as well.
The TSN 1290 NHL Midweek Hotline.
We welcome back to NHL Midweek Andrew Gross. He covers the New York Rangers for the Record newspaper in New Jersey. Andrew, good evening. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. How's it going tonight?
Doing very well, thank you, Andrew. You know, Jets fans were scoreboard watching yesterday, and probably the most surprising of the scores that we saw was that the Florida Panthers defeated the New York Rangers 3-2. We saw the Panthers here about a week and a half ago. We've seen their scores, you know, in all the Eastern Conference games. You know, it's stunning to us that the Rangers managed to lose to the Panthers. How did that actually unfold last night?
You know what? The Panthers just played a smart defensive game. They didn't, you know, the Rangers didn't fight through it. They didn't get enough traffic to the net. The only way to say it is they did not have the requisite level of desire to clinch a playoff spot the other day. They allowed the Panthers to beat them. And it's been an ongoing problem with the Rangers this season. As good as they've been playing in April, they still have these games where they just let it get away from them. You know, they outshoot an opponent. They have much more scoring chances, but they're not getting second chances. They're not crashing the net, and they're just not working for the 2 points they need right now. And you know, right now, it's inexcusable. I mean, the Panthers skate hard, and, you know, Jacob Markstrom played pretty decently, but again, he wasn't really tested on second shot.
Andrew, about 3 weeks ago, Marian Gaborik was traded by the New York Rangers to the Columbus Blue Jackets, and the other way came Derek Dorsett, John Moore, and Derek Brassard. Dorsett obviously is injured and hasn't played, but as far as Derek Brassard and John Moore goes, how would you rate the play of those two players so far?
Pretty good. I mean, Derek Brassard, a lot of talent there, but it's kind of the same thing, I guess, that, you know, his career in Columbus, you know, he's not at the same level every game or even from period to period. He's a tremendous stick handler, really good skater. But like last night, he was really visible maybe the first, you know, half of the first period, and then you didn't really notice him much the rest of the game. I think the Rangers are just really, like, thrilled they got out of this deal is the defenseman, John Moore. Mm-hmm. I think he's even surprised them with his skill level and his willingness to step up his physical game, which was one of the first things they asked him when he got here. He is a big body, but he's never really been that physical. And now he's taking the body more and really digging along the boards and just, you know, he's manning up a little bit more than when he came over from Columbus. And they're really, you can just tell John Tortorella loves this guy as a player and is really excited to get him into the lineup. He's being used on the power play now. And, you know, they love his big shot. So, it's all good for John Moore right now.
Yeah, Andrew, you know, talking about John Moore, Ryan McDonough, Michael Delzotto, that's a pretty mobile threesome there on the back end, probably some of the top three skaters in the National Hockey League in terms of defensemen.
Yeah. I mean, Delzotto's been, you know, kind of up and down in April, especially defensively. And, you know, as good as he is offensively, you know, Tortorella and the coaching staff always brings it back to, you know, some defensive gaps. And, you know, that maybe Delzato doesn't react as well, you know, when his defensive game is struggling. But, yeah, you know what? They move the puck and they look to move the puck. They don't just look to chip it up the boards or anything. They're looking to spring forwards and to be aggressive. And not just spring forwards. Delzato loves heading towards the crease and playing down low. So he definitely uses his skating ability that way.
Ezra mentioned the Columbus players that the Rangers acquired. What about Ryan Clough? Andrew, how has he performed after, obviously, the goal on the first night of his acquisition?
He's okay. I don't think he plays with the speed that the Rangers particularly like. I mean, you know, I know he's saying all the right things about wanting to stay here. You know, he's going to be an unrestricted free agent. You know, I don't think he's showing the Rangers the speed that they would want to invest in a multi-year deal in.
We're joined on NHL Midweek by Andrew Gross from the Record newspaper in New Jersey. You can follow us online at tsn1290.ca as well.
Andrew, you know, we talked about Derek Dorsett obviously being part of the acquisition from Columbus. He hasn't played yet. Seen that he was on the ice a little bit, but he hasn't been cleared for contact. If the Rangers do make the playoffs, which is very likely, is there a chance he would play in the first round?
Yeah, I think there's a very strong chance. I think he's, we're not talking weeks, I think he's days away from being ready. He's still not wearing a contact jersey in practice, but he's, you know, he's basically just waiting for that final doctor's medical clearance to jump back into the lineup, and it's not going to be a deal where once he gets medically cleared, he's going to have to go through a whole week of battle drills. I think he's going to, you know, test himself once, you know, in contact drills just to make sure the shoulder's okay. And then I think, you know, the Rangers will have him as an option. And I'm not saying, you know, that they're going to blow up their lineup to get him in, but at least they are going to have him available. And I think that's very, very soon.
And injuries, obviously. Injury talk in New York really starts and ends with, that's obviously aside from Dorsett, with Mark Stahl. And really having, I thought when he came to town, just a bounce back here, looked like his old self, obviously the terrible eye injury. Is there, you know, is there any word in terms of progress with that injury? And obviously the eye is so sensitive. If the Rangers, say, upset Pittsburgh, if they play Pittsburgh in the first round, could Mark Stahl possibly return this playoff run?
It's very possible. I mean, all this, the holdup right now, and I don't want to call it a holdup because that's not fair to Mark. His vision is blurred. He's learning to adjust to different depth perceptions, and, you know, basically his left eye is a stronger eye now. So he's just reteaching himself how to see things on the ice. And you know what? Until he feels comfortable with playing that way and that he's not going to put himself at risk, you know, it's unwise for him to play. But, you know, every day he's out there skating. Conditioning is not an issue. It's just a matter of Mark feeling comfortable that he can protect himself on the ice. I think he's getting, you know, he's not putting a timeline on it, but I would suspect that, you know, each day, you know, he's getting closer here as he practices and he's, you know, getting more used to what he's seeing. And, you know, it's a shame, you know, he hasn't officially been ruled out for tomorrow night's game, but, you know, I wouldn't suspect he's going to be back in the lineup, but what a great story that would be with Jared Stahl being called up. Mm-hmm. You know, so they're going to be three Stahls for the Hurricanes tomorrow.
Andrew, the Rangers re-signed an RFA late in the year. That was Matt Zuccarello. He had been playing over in Russia in the KHL. How has he fit in with the Rangers since he came back to the team at the end of March?
He's been great. I mean, he's obviously a great skater, and he's a great playmaker, and he finds people in areas, and then now the points are starting to come a little bit. He's got, you know, 3 goals, 4 assists, and really Taylor Pyatt's goal last night, it was only because of Matt Zuccarello and the way he got into the zone and then stick handled around the defenseman and was able to get the puck on net there. And that was like the one opportunity really the Rangers had where there was a second and third chance. John Moore got a poke at it at the crease, and John Moore's another one who, you know, another defenseman like Delzato who likes playing up a little bit. some more takes a whack at the puck around the net, and then, Taylor Pyatt's there just to kind of poke in the loose puck. And if there had been more of that last night, the Rangers would have won the game.
Andrew, before we let you go, we have to ask you about John Tortorella. I have a two-part question for you. How has Tortorella's demeanor been lately with, you know, the Rangers' playoff lives along the line? And do you personally believe, or you know, the way things are going, is there a chance that John Tortorella might lose his job if the Rangers don't make the playoffs or exit early in the first round?
I'll start at the end. No, I don't think. I think Torts will be the coach to starting next season, even if the Rangers lose these next two games. And I think, I was convinced of that when the Rangers traded away Marion Gabbert, because I really feel like the Rangers, you know, it was either going to be Gabby or John Tortorella, and they chose Tortorella. You know, it just wasn't working for Gabby playing for Tortorella here in New York. So I do think Torts does come back next season. I mean, his demeanor, you know, say this for John Tortorella, he doesn't really change. You know, I mean, he has days where he's engaging and analytical, and he has days where he just doesn't want to talk to anyone, particularly the media, and that never changes. You know, I mean, you know, he was good, you know, last week. I would say he was, you know, decent two or three times and not decent two or three times. So, you know, it's just part of the job description when you're around this team.
Andrew Gross covers the New York Rangers for the Bergen Record newspaper in New Jersey. Andrew, thanks very much for joining us this evening on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
My pleasure, guys. You have a good night.
You too, Andrew. Thanks very much. Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. 7:30 in the evening. Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg.
Prospect Pulse.
Prospect Pulse for this Wednesday evening means we are joined on the line by our good friend, the director of amateur scouting for Veritas Hockey, Kyle Kozier. KK, how are you, bud? Good evening.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Doing very well, thank you very much. We're going to focus on the Calgary Flames and their prospect system. Before we get into specific players, you know, if you had to pick a strength of the Flames organization, is there one area that you would point to?
You know, I really think I'd point to the developing that Flames type of player, you know, that essentially the Curtis Glencross type, who, you know, I realize he didn't come through the system, but they are deep in that type of player. They do very well with that type of player, and they seem to be able to, you know, if not consistently win, at least keep their head above water and compete with that type of player. You know, you look at guys that come in there, you know, the Lee Stepniaks and the Matt Stajans, they all seem to sort of find a home in Calgary playing that way, and I think that sort of, I don't know if it relates to their draft philosophy per se, but they seem to, you know, have quite a few guys like that in the system, and again, it seems to, you know, I'm loath to say it actually works for them, but they seem to do well, fairly well with those type of guys.
Kyle, you have a pretty good knowledge of most teams and their organizations and how they go about, you know, drafting players. The Flames obviously have a huge draft upcoming with three first-round picks. You know, are they in the upper echelon of teams in terms of their scouting system and everything along those lines?
You know, in terms of scouts you see around, you only ever see a few guys around. You know, I know a couple of the local guys here, and they all seem to sort of have a type, so I can't say for sure, you know, how that's going to translate, but they do certainly have a type of guys that they're looking for, and they stick with it. So I guess in terms of the organizational philosophy, they certainly know where they want to go, and I think that actually sometimes pays dividends too, rather than trying to go all over the map and not really have a plan. So you certainly can't fault them at least for that.
You know, you mentioned that they're not afraid to go off the map. They went way off the map last year, drafting that guy from the Quebec, you know, a high school league, pretty much. Just trying to find his name here.
Mark Jankowski?
Pardon me?
Jankowski?
Yeah, the guy that they drafted that really nobody else had heard of. You know,
yeah, that was certainly at the draft, there was a lot of puzzled looks at first.
Exactly right.
KK, we want to ask you about a couple of prospects here that were acquired in the Jerome Iginla trade, those being Kenny Agostino and Ben Hanowski. Start off with Kenny Agostino. He just won the NCAA final, Frozen Four, pardon me, with the Yale Bulldogs. He's told the Calgary Flames that he's going to return to Yale next year, but he's a guy that put up big numbers in Yale and contributed a lot in their playoff run, obviously. What do you like about him, and is he the type of guy that after he's done with Yale, you know, has a chance to make the Flames at, you know, 22, 23 years old?
Yeah, I certainly don't see a reason why not. You know, and aside from the fact that I love the guy's name, he sounds like he could be a Seinfeld character. he just has no quit in his game. You know, he's not a big, big guy. Like, I think he's listed about 5'10", 5'11", but, you know, probably a little bit south of there. But, gosh, he competes every shift, won't quit on pucks, won't quit on plays. You know, he scores a lot of goals by not giving up. You know, he doesn't, not one of those guys that takes a shot and peels away from the net. He shoots and goes right to the net and is starting to dig that rebound out type of thing. Which is not to say he's sort of one-dimensional player that way. He's quite fast, does have, you know, other offensive skills. But I really, really like that compete level because it's paid dividends for him. And I think you'll see him in more of a feature role for Yale going forward. And, you know, they certainly are going to have a good team again next year. And they recruit well. And so he's in a good situation there, and certainly no need for the Flames to rush him.
Kyle, a sore spot for the Flames, really, not necessarily Mika Kiprusoff, but after Mika Kiprusoff, they've been through many backup goalies over the past number of years. Their top goaltending prospect is John Gillies. What kind of goaltender is he, and what are the expectations for him?
Well, he's got that skill that everybody likes these days, and that he's 6'5". This seems to be almost a fetish for these big goalies now. He's not to say he can't play. He posted really fantastic numbers at Providence this year. I think it was, you know, like 931 or something like that, save percentage. You know, fairly good one-loss record, but, you know, he's obviously stopping the bulk of the pucks that he sees. But, you know, with that large frame, just like, I guess, like a, you know, say like a Devin Dubnyk, they fill up so much net. And it's not like the old days where goalies were just sort of the big guy. You've got an athletic skill and certainly knows how to play the game. So, again, just a freshman at Providence, came out of the USHL, so likely not ready just yet. But, you know, if they can kind of find a good stopgap for a while, he might be the answer down the road.
You're listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. We're joined by Director of Amateur Scouting for Veritas Hockey, Kyle Kozier. We're talking about the Calgary Flames and their prospects. Kyle, a guy familiar to Winnipeg Jets fans, even if it is for his very brief time with the Jets organization, is Akeem Alou. You know, he was a property of the Winnipeg Jets. He didn't fit into the Jets' plans, and eventually he ended up in Calgary, and he played some time with the Flames farm system in Abbotsford. You know, it seems like he's done more with his career in Calgary than he has anywhere else. Is this just the sign of a player finally maturing and maybe finding a role in the NHL?
I think so, too. You know, he's somewhat well-known to, you know, Canadian hockey fans that he had sort of a rough start in junior. He had that incident with Steve Downey ways back. He's, you know, had suspension troubles, injury troubles, bounced around from team to team to team to team. But I think he's, like you say, you know, finally found a good spot in Calgary there. The coaches down in, or I guess I should say out in Abbotsford, are really good teaching coaches. I know, you know, both a couple of guys quite well. And really, I think their strength is they can get the most out of every player, you know, find what buttons to push. And I think, you know, Lou is finally in that spot where he's got coaches that, you know what to look for in him and can get everything out of him. And so hopefully that, you know, get that play out of him that everybody thought he could be. And, you know, he's about 24, 25 years old now, so it's, you know, he's really kind of running out of time prospect-wise. But, you know, if anybody can do what those guys can, and you know, you hope he's got a career ahead of him here.
KK, the next guy we wanted to ask you about was Brady Lamb. And before I ask the question, though, do you know if he's related to former Oiler Mark Lamb?
You know, I don't know that. I know he's okay. A Calgary kid,
yep.
But I can't say for sure that he is any relation there. I actually just haven't followed up on that.
Okay, I'll try to find it out via the magic powers of Google, and then I'll text you that. But
while he's eating a lamb,
exactly. As I'm eating a lamb shawarma, Kyle. But as far as Brady Lamb goes, the Flames signed him about 3 weeks ago, late March. He's out of University of Minnesota Duluth. I believe he's unsigned. What have you seen out of Brady Lamb, and is he a guy that can possibly step into the Flames, you know, organization fairly quickly?
Yeah, I really think so. He's one of those guys that, you know, he sort of translated a big shot and some good offensive skills into putting up fairly good points in Duluth. That's really a skilled team there. A lot of people sort of overlook because, you know, North Dakota and Minnesota are in the same conference there, but they play with a lot of skill, they practice with a lot of skill, and Lamb fits right into that mold there. It's not to say that he's purely an offensive guy. He's got some grit to his game. He doesn't mind playing the more defensive style, but I think Duluth employed him in that offensive role. But like a lot of other Calgary players, prospects, he can almost like a chameleon in that he can fit into several different roles. So if he can find a spot for himself in Calgary and they can utilize him right, I don't see a reason why he kind of can't step in and, you know, either maybe take some heat off Giordano or, you know, not a type of guy that's going to fill in for Boomeister, but again, he can, you know, certainly slide in at the bottom and maybe work his way up into more of a feature role for Calgary and certainly on the farm team.
Certainly, you know, Kyle, there's a change in management in terms of Jay Feaster taking over for Daryl Sutter and then Bob Harley taking over for Brent Sutter. Totally different styles of play, really. Is that going to be, are we going to start seeing totally different drafting styles as well, you know, on a go-forward basis?
Yeah, that's an interesting question in that, you know, the Flames, despite the roster moves they made, they're just still kind of reluctant to say that they're rebuilding. So it'd be interesting to see what they do behind closed doors in terms of what they want to look for. You know, if they want to draft what the coaches want and that kind of thing, then yeah, you might see a little bit different, maybe a trend towards a little bit more skill and, you know, a little less sandpaper because, mm-hmm. you know, to be honest, they have enough of that in the system anyways. So I really think, just like other teams, and I really think they need to sort of come up with a philosophy and go with it for a while just to, you know, try and have that top-to-bottom situation where everybody's pulling in the same direction. You see a lot of different teams where the farm teams do the same thing the NHL club does and just make that transition so seamless. So I think that really translates right down to the drafting, too.
Kyle, a guy familiar to hockey fans throughout the province of Manitoba. He's from Swan River, Manitoba. He also played for the Brandon Wheat Kings, Michael Furland. What's his ceiling as a player? You know, what's his strength? He was the fifth-round pick of the Flames a number of years ago.
You know, I hate to sound like a broken record, but a lot of the ceiling depends on his skating. Obviously, he's a talented scorer. He's got a quick release, an accurate shot. You know, he's pretty good in tight there. But again, his skating holds him back a little bit. At the junior hockey level, you can obviously get away with a little bit more in that he's so talented with the puck, the skating doesn't, you know, create such of an issue. But when he graduates to the pro ranks there, he's really going to have to work on both the skating and a little bit of the attention to detail in the defensive zone, especially on a team like the Flames. You can't really let that go. So I guess it really depends on what he's willing to put into it. You know, if he can get it into his head that he's going to have to, you know, complete his game and not just rely on that quick shot and the offensive skills. And, you know, he certainly has that, you know, third line, maybe top out of the second line, sort of secondary scorer type, sort of where I see him. But again, he's got to put the work in first.
KK, the other guy that was acquired in that Iginla deal was Ben Hanowski.
Right.
What do you like about his game, and how would you characterize him as a player, and what is his ceiling as a prospect for the Flames?
I guess in terms of the ceiling, that's kind of a tough one, too. I'd probably say that, you know, tops out as a second-line guy, maybe a third-liner. The thing I like about him is he not super fast, doesn't really have that quick first step, but he can beat you a number of ways. He's really good on the cycle. He can create a lot of stuff where you might not otherwise, you know, see a chance. He can usually put something together. He has very good hands, especially, again, like we discussed with Furman, good hands in tight. He is more of a shooter than a playmaker, and he's got, again, a good release and is pretty lethal with there, too. So if he can develop a little bit more and get accustomed to the speed of the pro game, I really think he can be a good second-line or secondary scorer for the Flames.
Kyle Kocher, Director of Amateur Scouting for Veritas Hockey, we thank you, as always, for joining us on NHL Midweek. Thanks very much, KK. Have a good one, bud.
Yeah, for sure, guys. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, KK.
Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. 1 final segment on this Wednesday evening. Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Michael Remus is on loan to us from Rick Ralph and the Rona Roundtable. An interesting week. Really an interesting last couple days in terms of relationship between the media and the people who and the teams and the players and the coaches that they cover. Which clip do we have first? Do we have Claude Noel from last night first, or do we have Duncan Keith from two nights ago in Vancouver?
Let's do Duncan Keith. We'll go in chronological order.
This is Duncan Keith talking to a reporter in Vancouver after the Canucks beat the Chicago Blackhawks on Monday night.
What did you see?
Well, there was some, there looked like maybe there was a penalty that went undetected. You seemed a bit frustrated.
Oh no, I don't think there was. I think he scored a nice goal, and that was that's what the ref was right there. That's what the ref saw. And we should get you as a ref, maybe, hey?
Yeah, maybe.
First female referee. You can't play probably either, right? But you're thinking the game, like, you know what? Mm-hmm. Okay, see ya.
Any problem with that interaction? Did you know people were saying sexism and things of that nature? Did you find it to be sexist, or was it just sort of jerky?
Both.
You thought it was sexist?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, it's the first time I'd heard it. I'd read the transcript. I wanted to hear it for the first time on the show. A little bit. That was a little bit. That was demeaning. The question I was referring to a slash after a goal.
Yeah.
Not something that was really going to get called. I know Keith and Sedin have history, but it's tough after a game. He's obviously frustrated. That's something he probably ought to apologize for. Again, we're going to talk about Noel in a second. It doesn't have to be a public apology. Just going to say, I didn't mean for it to come across that way. But I thought that was a little bit demeaning.
Yeah. Duncan Keith did apologize today in a scrum. Not to her, I don't think specifically, but it mentioned her, Richie. But I don't think it is so much sexist as far as jerky. Now, first and foremost, I was brought up to treat all women with the utmost respect, and you should never disrespect any women or anybody in general, but specifically women, because they're better than us. Second of all, Duncan Keith is the type of guy who is a very passionate guy. He said this today when he was asked about it. And he said he was passionate, and he apologized. To his credit, he manned up. But, you shouldn't be like that to anybody, especially a female who's just doing her job and just asking a question. And I love Duncan Keith. He's from Winnipeg. I think he deserves strong Norris consideration this year. Great defenseman. But, he was disrespectful. He was out of line there.
I don't think he was any more disrespectful to her than he would be to any male reporter who asked the question.
I thought the way he said it was a little bit demeaning to her in terms of as a woman. But let's quickly take a look at the question. Why are you asking about a penalty that wasn't called on a slash after a goal that's seemingly irrelevant? The question is a stupid question. And while he shouldn't have answered that way, she shouldn't have asked that question because it was a stupid question.
And that's a journalist's job, for the one guy who has a journalism diploma on the panel. The one thing is, Richie, especially post-game, just remember what you were going to say because I'll add to it. Okay, well, I haven't said anything.
The question doesn't have to do with anything. I mean, it's not like Noel's question.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm supporting your point. I agree with you in that it wasn't the best question, but that's part of what, let's be honest. These guys have to ask questions after losses, after wins. That's part of their job. But some of the questions that these guys asked are a little bit ridiculous. I mean, ask the questions about the game. I mean, it's one of those things that you ask a guy, oh, you missed on the shootout. Why didn't you score? Well, I was trying to score. I mean, there are certain questions.
Hang on,
let
Richie get in here. He's fired up.
No. But I understand that, we'll talk about Noel and Pannon in a second. You had to ask, about the game, and it was a hard game. But this question, you're not asking it for any reason. Are you asking it for an article? Are you asking it for post-game interview? I mean, what's the purpose of asking why you
scored? Yeah, what's the angle?
What's it going to say? Yeah, should have been a penalty?
Yeah, unless the question is, unless the premise is that the officiating was terrible in that game, which it certainly wasn't.
But he didn't call a penalty on it.
I know.
So that's why it doesn't make any sense.
Well, especially, it's odd. That's a question that that should be better asked to the
Sedin.
The Sedin.
Yeah.
Sedin, if you don't score on that, or even if you,
Again, but a stupid question doesn't excuse him being, to me, overly demeaning about it. He would just say, that wasn't a penalty, or, next question even. Next question is less demeaning than that.
In fairness, here's Duncan Keith today in Edmonton, his apology. He says he was fired up after an emotional loss and meant no disrespect to women. There was no intent for my point. Yeah. I respect everybody. I respect everybody's job. He was asked if you differentiate between male and female reporters. He replied, no, I've got CSN, Comcast Sportsnet, Chicago
Tracy
reporter,
Myers,
Tracy Myers here. I deal with her all the time. She's a great reporter. Yeah. And then Tracy Myers actually came to Duncan Keith's defense saying that they have a nice of Duncan Keith to give me the scrum shout out, but not necessary.
we've always had a good, respectful working relationship.
Again, I don't think it was demeaning to her in terms of as being a woman. It doesn't mean every woman is demeaning to. And also, give him kudos. He came out. He apologized as he should have.
Yeah.
And it's water under the bridge. It's emotional.
Let's talk about the Claude Noel last night in response to a question from Kirk Penton.
What was that? This is the second year you've asked me that question. It's got to be the dumbest question in the world. Last year you asked me in New York Islanders, how difficult is that loss? Are you serious? Like, you serious on that question?
I guess just the general feeling.
Wow.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
What was the biggest reason for that loss?
Well, they played better than us.
You know, the thing is, I don't think it's that dumb of a question. It's a question that has to be asked in that time. The Jets have just lost a game in which, you know, they took a pretty good blow to their playoff chances. So, yeah, is it a bit of a generic question? Sure. But is it an outrageously bad question? No. I didn't think so. I don't think it deserved that reaction.
Again, that's a demeaning answer. Unnecessary. You knew it was coming. Like, Claude knew it was coming. How does he remember what Appy asked him in New York Islanders last year? He's coached 125 games. So, to me, or whatever, more than that, to me, I just think that, again, it's in the heat of the moment. But should he have answered that way? No. I thought that was out of line. And he degraded him twice. And why? I mean, the guy is doing his job. If you don't like the question, just say next question. I mean, for all we don't like about John Tortorella, if he says next question, then fine, next question. It's less degrading than putting you than saying something like that in front of all of your colleagues. I don't like it.
People think that these questions are sometimes stupid or they're not the best questions. It's not easy. I mean, I do the visitor room every game. Sometimes. You know, I'm the only one asking questions because there's no local media in there. And I'll tell you this much right now. Sometimes you have scripted questions. Sometimes you have to just ask a question because, you have the time and you have to ask a question. So sometimes your questions aren't, the most creative or maybe the most... They're not... Let's say this, Drew. Not every single question is going to be a home run.
Not every question is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigation.
Exactly. Sometimes you just have to ask, okay, what went wrong there? And the thing is... You know, it sucks after a loss. And that was a big game, and Claude Noel's not going to be happy. But I'm sure that, he doesn't feel good about it, or, he shouldn't at least. And I don't think Kirk Penton really deserved that. And, this isn't an overarching criticism of Claude Noel.
No.
It's just he was in a bad mood, and he overreacted. And I'm sure that, looking back on it, he probably wishes he didn't answer that way.
Yeah, and should he apologize? I think so. I mean, hold on. Apologize privately. It doesn't have to be publicly.
Mm-hmm.
Apologize privately. It's water under the bridge. I mean, it's not something you hold over his head for the rest of his life. It's what I like about Noel and Keith, I don't like the comments and the tone. But I like the emotion after a loss.
Right.
That's what I like. That's what makes them that competitive spirit makes them good. You know, it's a classic. What was the line by Eddie DeBartolo in that Football Life on NFL Network? It's I'll show you a good loser is a loser. Like basically like that.
Yeah.
If you're that happy after, then you obviously it doesn't bother you that much. So I understand that. But coming back at him again, by the way, at the end of the interview, at the end of the scrum.
Yeah.
I mean, let it go.
Yeah, what surprises me, and I agree with
and
all.
Let me quickly get in here.
Sure.
By the way, I mean let's be honest here. The media in Winnipeg is not harsh on Claude Noel. I mean, and I'm not saying he deserves harsh criticism, but the media here isn't exactly hard on Claude Noel. It's not like Montreal here. So, if you want to keep him in your good graces, you might want to be a little bit more respectful. So an apology will do that. But if this happens more than once, then it becomes an issue.
What I'm sort of surprised about, is the people, and I know this is just crowdsourcing on Twitter, and it's the people who only decide to chime up. They almost unanimously sided with, they thought that what Claude Noel did was appropriate, saying, well, ask better questions. To me, the mark of a man or the mark of a person is not how you treat people when the going is good. The mark of a person is how you treat somebody when you have the opportunity to lash out, and you have somebody sitting there as a duck that could be taken advantage of. I mean, most media people are just going to stand there and take it because they don't want to make themselves the story. So the mark of that is to me is just to move along and treat it
you know, treat it as if you don't like the question, but you don't, like you said, have to demean the guy because it's too easy of a target, and it doesn't say a lot for you as an individual, in my estimation, at that point.
As long as it's an exception, not the rule, it's fine.
Exactly right.
Keep your eye on.
Ezra Ginsberg, keep your eye on.
Todd Bertuzzi. He's only played 10 or 11 games this year. He's got an injury.
If you turn your back, he'll hit you.
Exactly. He's not playing tonight versus the LA Kings, but he's scheduled to come back this weekend for Detroit's last game of the year. So keep your eye on him. He's a guy that they sorely miss because he's a veteran. He adds a lot in the dressing room, and he can add some offense still. He's changed his game quite a bit as he's gotten older. He's 38 now. But, you know, Detroit is playing LA right now. They're tied. No score, but Detroit has a game in hand on Columbus. They're fighting for their playoff lives. And I think a guy like Todd Bertuzzi is a good guy to have in your lineup when it matters most.
By the way, if Detroit loses this game, given Columbus' schedule...
And no Dustin Brown.
Same schedule after this game, though.
Right. But, I mean, if Detroit loses this game, Columbus should get the eighth playoff spot.
I'll do my keep an eye on quickly here. I know we're up against it. Andrew Gross actually referred to this earlier, but keep an eye on tomorrow's game in Carolina. Carolina against the Rangers. Mark Stahl's probably not going to play, but the three other Stahl brothers are going to play.
Yep.
And that's going to be a pretty cool experience for that family. So kudos to them. I mean, it's like the Sutters. It's modern-day Sutters, and it's awesome.
Jared Stahl called up by the Carolina Hurricanes, and he'll play with his brothers Eric and Jordan Stahl. That's it for this Wednesday in NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. A big thank you to our guest, Pat Hickey of the Montreal Gazette, and Andrew Gross from the Record newspaper in New Jersey. In case you missed any of the program, it will be available for download both on illegalcurve.com and on tsn1290.ca. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/illegalcurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com. Saturday afternoon, 12 noon until 3 p.m., it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. If the Jets are still alive, we'll bring you live coverage or live updates on the Devils-Rangers game, which will be going on at the same time as we're on air. Monday evening, regardless, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., an NHL Stanley Cup playoff preview with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Stay tuned to us on Twitter at Illegal Curve as we update you on the guests. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and our website is www.illegalcurve.com. For Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, for producer Michael Remus, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Until Saturday afternoon, we wish you good night and good luck.
You've been listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve. Join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for your midweek NHL update. And join Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg Saturdays for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on your home of the Winnipeg Jets and all things NHL. TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.